You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, all over the world at kpfk.org. It's once again time for Melting Pot here every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. My name is Michael Barnes, and I'm your usual host for this program. And today, what we're going to do is pay tribute to a friend of mine who passed away on Labor Day, a DJ out of the Bay Area. His name was Matthew Africa, and I'm going to play music that he turned me on to, things that I know that he liked and that he loved, and you'll actually hear him at various times during the show too. And Oliver Wang, another good friend of his, is going to be here, and we're going to chat about him, play you a lot of music just to remember Matthew. And so I'm going to start things off with something that actually for a while after I met him, I didn't realize the effect that he had had on me until it just kind of came on me all of a sudden. But Matthew had put out, or helped put out, a collection on the Love and Hate record label called Jazz Dance Classics Volume Number 1. And many of the tracks on there really inspired me to get out and start digging and looking for music that wasn't in print and that was almost invariably on vinyl. And so this was one of the heaviest tracks on there, and still one of the heaviest tracks I've ever heard. Rusty Bryant's The Fire Eater, right now on KPFK and Melting Pot, in tribute to Matthew Africa. We'll be right back.
that's all that lives is gonna die. And there'll always be some people here to wonder why. And for every happy hello, there will be goodbye. There'll be time for you to put yourself on. Then you should be the first to wanna make this change. And for everyone who thinks that life is just a game, do you like the part you're playing? I'll see your picture. It's in the same old frame. We meet again. You look so lovely. You with the times that I've been given such a little while, and the things that I must do consist of more than style. There'll be time for you to start all over. This is the time, and this is the time, and it is
you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Melting Pot, name of the show. Currently doing a tribute to a friend of mine who passed away recently, Matthew Africa. I played you a couple songs in a set that I associate with him. One coming from Arthur Lee in Love from the record Forever Changes. You Set the Scene, the name of it, from the 2001 remastered edition of it, which I'm not sure. I can't remember the first time that I met Matthew, but it would have been connected to some record that I did a review for Calyx, the radio station in Berkeley. And that was one of them, and just kind of talking to him about it. It was a record that he really loved, and so he appreciated the words that I had said about it, and you know that was part of the beginning of that. Ahead of that was something that for years I didn't realize Matthew actually played a part in it, and had a profound effect on me as a DJ. You heard Rusty Bryant's "The Fire Eater." It's from an album that I want to say is of the same title on the Prestige record label. But I originally heard it for the first time on a collection put out by Love and Hate, which is started up by Michael and Jody McFadden, started Groove Merchant, and also Ubiquity Records and Love and Hate. Jazz Dance Classics Volume Number 1 was where that came off of, and that was actually a record that Matthew was involved in. He did the liner notes for it. He credits the McFaddens for choosing the songs, but he also talks about how he played that song on Benny B's record radio show in Berkeley on Calyx, and how, you know, the phones just lit up. And that's basically the case almost every single time I played that song after hearing it when I did my own jazz show in Atlanta called The Blue Note. It just every time, because every single person on that song just kills things, just murdering notes everywhere around, just incredible sounds. And something that really got me starting to look for things that were a little bit beyond the pale. I'd heard, you know, a lot of deep music, or what I thought was a lot of deep music at the time. I was very proud of myself, thought I knew some deep things, but that kind of started me making me realize that there was a lot more to find, and wasn't going to find it on CD. Had to start digging for vinyl, and for that I'm eternally grateful, and I'm thankful that I was able to tell him the effect that he had on me just with that that collection and his involvement in it. In the background is music from Billy Harper, another artist kind of we shared. Harper was Matthew's favorite living saxophonist. This comes from his record In Europe. The song is Priestess from Billy Harper. One of the things I'm also really, really proud of and really, really happy that I was able to do was to DJ with Matthew quite a few times in Oakland back when I was living in the Bay Area. One of the nights in particular that I'm really happy I was able to attend was his 30th birthday party, along with Joe Quicks and Sean Sullivan and Kitty, all of us DJing, and I DJed just before Matthew, and his father was there kind of tripping out just on all the people, and it was a really great time, and Matthew, this is a funk night pretty much, playing nothing but straight funk, and Matthew starts his set off with Crosstown Traffic from Jimi Hendrix, and didn't lose a single person off the dance floor. It was perfectly timed. And I wanted to start this next set off with that. There are also some words between Oliver Wang and Matthew Africa just about how he started becoming a kind of collector and digging for things, even though I don't think he liked that term too much, but, you know, finding rare things out there and about. And so you hear that in addition to a couple other artists and songs that that Matthew really loved. And Oliver will be back with me in the next break, too. So here's music right now from Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix Experience, Crosstown Traffic, the name of the song, from Electric Ladyland, here on a tribute to Matthew Africa on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Your back, I can see you had your fun, but darling, can't you see my sin? What got you first started in collecting records in general?
You know, I think what really got me started probably was the first time I started buying some things that weren't on the radio. And I think it was Jimi Hendrix records that, you know, some of the more left field stuff. I somehow got sucked into that. And, you know, just all of a sudden I realized that used record stores were the place to go. And it got me curious about a lot of other things. Also, about that time, I was maybe 12, 13 years old, I came across a remainder copy of an anthology of Robert Christgau consumer guide reviews. And that had an enormous influence on my taste in terms of, you know, just sort of like going through and trying to find all the A-plus records, which, you know, led me to listen to things like, you know, the New York Dolls and Sly Stone at a time when I didn't necessarily appreciate them. But then, you know, I sort of began to really be exposed to a lot of phenomenal music.
You know, it's funny because someone turned me on to his consumer guide, and it, you know, this was many years ago, but I'm wondering if it might have been you, in fact, because I had, even though I was writing about music, I hadn't really, in a sense, discovered Christgau yet, but at some point, someone said, you should really read his, I think it was probably his 70s guide, and I'd sat down, and I mean, I think part of what I was interested in was just what were the A-plus records, but I think what I also learned from it is that he just had such an economic, you know, writing form. I mean, he was super efficient that he could say, you know, in just 100 words, something kind of meaningful about a particular record, which at the time I was sort of going the opposite direction where I'm trying to say as much as I possibly can. And Christgau was like, it was so clean to a certain degree. I mean, at times a little bit dismissive. I think one of the reviews in the 70s book was, it was for an Ohio Players record, and all I think he read was like Shubidi Bop or something, or Oogity Boogity or something, and like that was it.
Shubidi Boogity. And then I think he reviewed a following record, and it was like Boogity Shubidi or something. Yeah. You know, I think he did a lot to shape my early listening habits because he was so focused on the album as a form. That is, you know, it being this format that was of songs that had to be over 30 minutes long. If it were less than 30 minutes, there'd be some annotation about, you know, how it was a short record. And then, you know, it had to be not just one good song or two good songs, but plus filler, but something that was sort of, you know, striving for this ideal where every song was unique and special and somehow they formed some greater part. And, you know, for a long time when I was buying records, that was really what I hoped to find every time I grabbed something new.
Stand here all alone. take your hand, babe. Together we'll get away. This much sadness is too much sorrow. It's impossible for me to stay.
Train my brain when I
Music from Sly and the Family Stone here on KPFK, Melting Pot, a tribute to Matthew Africa. Sly and the Family Stone, one of his favorite bands, and There's a Ride Going On was actually his favorite record, and I think the last thing that he played on Calyx, I think, was from that record. Probably Thank You for Talking to Me, Africa. But I want to play Can't Strain My Brain, part of just because, you know, the sentiment just seems right. And also, I remember during a fundraiser at Calyx, Matthew telling me how much he loved the horns in that song, and tripping out that the copy that I had was a different copy. It was just a weird press, had different sounds on it, a little different version of that. And Time for Living. Also in the set, you heard music from Buddy Miles from his album Them Changes, his version of Neil Young's Down by the River. Neil Young, an artist Matthew adored, and he really loved that particular version. And that's something I know there's in Calyx, and that incredible library in Calyx that has so many records with Matthew's handwriting and his notes on it. There's one in there for that record that I'm pretty sure he got for the station that just talks about how heavy that song is, and truly it was. You also heard in there a little bit of Oliver Wang talking with Matthew Africa, just talking about how he started actually going out to buy records and started off in some ways with music of Jimi Hendrix, and that's what we had at the top of the set. Crosstown Traffic, the name of the song, which I still have vivid memories of Matthew playing at the Ruby Room back in 2001 for his 30th birthday. And Oliver Wang is here in the studios with me. Oliver, you also were really, really good friends with Matthew. And one of the things we were talking about off the mic was just how it's still a little difficult to believe.
Yeah.
And kind of process. And yeah.
I would just start by saying that, number one, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wish it was under better circumstances.
Exactly.
But it seems really apropos because I think both of us met Matthew at a different 90.7. This would be KALX FM mm-hmm. up in Berkeley.
Yeah.
You know, I met him probably, God, maybe as early as 91 or 92. And, you know, one of the things we also talked about off mic is just how incredibly influential he was. Certainly, I think, on each of us individually, but just on so many different people without it being such an obvious thing until you're sort of forced to reflect upon someone's legacy after their passing. But, you know, with Matthew, in terms of my taste in records, in terms of, as you heard in that clip, you know, as a music writer, I sort of discovered Robert Christgau's writing through him. So many different levels of it, and it's just really extraordinary of thinking over the 20 years that I knew him, how much in conscious and subconscious ways I really learned from him, and, you know, which only accents and accentuates just how much I'm going to miss not being able to have, you know, those kind of conversations. But I think he left behind such an amazing legacy with the people that he touched, the music that he wrote about, you know, and his radio audience. And he loved doing radio, even though I think, like myself, the terrestrial radio grind, which you still have the passion for it, which I have much respect for. but I think it was, you know, he loved connecting with an audience, whether it was through an online or through terrestrial radio. And, you know, I think that the romance of radio is something that he always had within him.
Yeah, he really loved sharing beautiful music.
Yeah.
You know, music that he enjoyed, that he thought other people would dig or should dig as well. You know, in the background right now is one of the many mixes that Matthew left us with. He really didn't do a lot of mixes. You know, like back when we were in Berkeley and we were at Calyx, he didn't do like a ton of mixes back then. But just like in the last, I don't know, six, seven years, really started producing all these incredible mixes.
Yeah.
This Mizell Brothers one is, I did a tribute to the Mizell Brothers, and this one is like so far and away better than what I did. It's like, it's just amazing. Like I listened to it and I'm just like, okay, like I remember that song, but I don't, at the same time, I don't remember that. Like,
right,
what?
Right.
There's like a song from the Mizell Brothers and Marvin Gaye on here I didn't even know about. And it's just like, that's constant with Matthew.
Yeah. I mean, he really had, I think, one of the best record collections in the Bay Area. But the thing is, a lot of people didn't always realize it because he was never the type to crow about it. You know, he kind of kept it on the low. But he also wasn't, doing it as a way of keeping it secret. He wasn't selfish with his knowledge. The one thing that you'll hear from so many people who've known him is how generous he was in sharing and putting people up on stuff. So he wasn't hoarding it. He just wasn't the type to kind of go out and floss with it. Unlike, well, we don't have to name names, but it's such a contrast in personality that, you know, the record collecting community has a lot of eccentric and sometimes quite dysfunctional personalities. And he was just really one of the nicest, genuine dudes that were out there. And I think that's partly what people are just feeling in his loss, is that, you know, he was really one of the best people in this community of folks that we know. And yeah,
you know, there are a lot of guys that have, and some women too, that have that same kind of level of, you know, have crazy record collections. People who are really skilled DJs who've been either in hip hop or, you know, like connected to kind of hip hop culture, and for them, either because of how they came up or their perspective or whatever, you know, there's almost that kind of guarded kind of sense that, like, you know, like these are like, you should, in some ways I work to find these things, you shouldn't know them.
Yeah.
And Matthew was never like that. He was, and we talked about this at some other time, or I was reading something you were writing, how like on his radio show, he would play these like crazy, insane, absolutely, like he was probably the only one or two people who had them or knew about them and would just play them.
Yeah.
Almost like it was just, you know, it was Tuesday or whatever day it was, you know, for his show. And just put us on to so much music.
Right, right. I mean, I think I have more of the, you know, knowledge. There's knowledge is power, and you have to earn the right to be able to listen to certain things. And
I know.
I don't think Matthew ever had that same kind of attitude. Even though, I mean, it's not like he liked everything. I mean, when he didn't like something, he would be very candid with his opinion about it.
Man,
but
the worst one I can remember is some. It wasn't even an argument, just because at that point I think I knew him well enough that it was like, you know, what's the point? And I think he kind of felt like he knew me well enough that it was also kind of like, what's the point? So we'd just kind of like say whatever we're saying in like a jokey manner.
Yeah.
But like he did not like Donny Hathaway. And what did he say? He said something like, yeah, he said like he was,
wow.
What did he say?
How do you not like Donny Hathaway?
Dude, because he said something. It was like, he was like emblematic of like the bourgeoisification of soul music or something like that. And most people who would say something like that, I would seriously put in their place.
Yeah.
But when Matthew had the knowledge and actually would have had a point, like if I had wanted to keep going there with him.
Right.
I just simply said, you know, man, I just love his voice.
Yeah.
And that was like, that was it between us, because there was there was no working around either one of those.
Yeah.
But I mean, but yeah, you know, when he didn't like something, he really didn't like something.
That's funny.
But there was so much that he did like. I don't know. I mean, even I feel like I have pretty diverse tastes. You have really diverse tastes. You know, we know like a handful of people who are kind of in this and have legitimately really diverse tastes, but there are a few people I know who are like so deep into so many things like Matthew was.
Right. I'm also cognizant of it, you know, us being two guys from the Bay Area, or at least who met Matt up in the Bay, being in LA, and maybe a lot of locals who listen to your show aren't necessarily, you know, as intimately familiar. You know, take a few minutes out, Google his name, his content, his site's going to hopefully still be up for a long time to come. And, you know, the mixes that that Michael was talking about, I mean, just Mizell Brothers. He had a great, like, four-part series of 90s independent hip-hop that was amazing. Uh-huh. I mean, the Soul Boulders mix that he did with DJ B-Kaz are, you know, two of the greatest kind of mid-tempo, slow jam, funky mixes I've ever heard. So, I mean, he left behind like a really remarkable amount of curation that that are still out there for public consumption. And I really urge people to take use of it. It would have made him happy to know that people, you know, were listening to this, you know, his stuff like that.
Yeah, and you know, like I think you know, there were so many people that were kind of looking up his music. When we heard, most of us heard on Thursday, I guess, that it seemed like the site crashed.
Yeah,
it seemed like it's back up.
I think so.
It seems like it's back up, and you can get all the music that he put up there. But I mean, you know, it really was just kind of the same. Well, I mean, it wasn't quite the same, but it was an extension of kind of like what he did on the radio. But it was really nice. It seemed like, and I don't know if it was. I never got a chance to talk to him about it. Whether or not it was just something as simple as kind of you know, like Serato technology. Kind of freeing him up in a different way, especially with the kind of, you know, like rare stuff that he had. It's not stuff that you necessarily want
right.
to be messing around with all the time, you know?
I think a lot of it had to actually do with the transition from going from doing a live radio show like what we're doing right now to doing an online show where there's more flexibility in the schedule. And I think he felt like, given that, he needed to step things up and be able to think through and plan things out. And that was a big compulsion around why he put so much time to making those mixes. But it, you know, you just listen to it and you can hear the labor and the kind of thought that went into it, which certainly existed with his live shows as well. I mean, he brought through so much amazing music during his many, many years on Calyx. Yeah,
it seemed there was a period of time, like I met Matthew, it must have been in 2000. Because by 2001, I was already pretty much hanging out with him and Kitty at the Ruby Room.
Kitty.
Where they did Wednesday nights. And I was just kind of like the spot and just a really formative time for me. You know, some of the best times that I had as a DJ and a dancer and just a music lover and just, you know, like that was something I mean, and you know, both of us have PhDs from Berkeley. Like that was something I really needed when I was in grad school. And like, if it hadn't been there, I don't know, you know, but that was, it really was kind of like salvation for me. And just the way I never felt like I was a particularly skilled DJ or anything like that, and I felt like I knew a good bit of stuff, but nowhere near as deep as like Matthew or Joe. But just nothing but love always from him, and just that I think that's one of the big qualities that I'll always remember and really take with me with Matthew, is just that genuine generosity and just his sincerity. You know, is one of the most like, and we, you know, especially again in the academic thing, you know, that the term authenticity kind of gets thrown around too much, and some people feel like it's a wasted term. But Matthew was like he was a real authentic dude, and
he never made it seem like he was trying that hard.
Exactly.
I mean, I feel like I put a lot of effort into the things I do, and that it can come off seeming kind of, you know, contrived as a result. And he just made it seem so easy that it was just such a natural part. And maybe, you know, behind the scenes, you know, he was self-conscious and all these things that other folks like us have neuroses around, but I mean, he was just so cool about it in that sense. And but like you said, genuine and a kind soul. I also wanted to say, you know, my thoughts certainly go out to his widow, who's still recovering in the hospital, and
all,
know,
his family.
Right. Because I know, I mean, this has been such a shock, and people are just really just coping with an immense loss that I think
we're still processing through mm-hmm. in that respect. Yeah, this is kind of a bummer show, but you know.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a tough thing because on the one hand, it's like you definitely I felt like if we didn't talk about them, that somehow that would be wrong. And at the same time, it's like I really want to, you know, like I want to celebrate his life and celebrate music that he loved.
Absolutely.
And try and do it in a total way. You know, like he really loved Damo Suzuki and Khan. He liked Khan in general, but Damo Suzuki and Khan, he really loved. And that's the reason why it's in the background right now.
Yeah.
And just like the conversations you would have with him about music. It was funny. Like, I don't know. I'm sure you probably went record shopping with him at some point or another, but I can't actually remember if I ever saw Matthew in a record store when I knew him, even though I know he was constantly shopping for records.
No, you know, the only time that happened is when he used to work at Amoeba. Uh-huh. I was one of those scrubs who would be just literally waiting for him to put out new used stock, and usually he priced a lot of the hip-hop promo stuff, uh-huh. and there'd just be a little gaggle of like toys like myself waiting for him just to drop stuff in the bins, and it'd be like a feeding frenzy. And that was pretty much the only time I ever saw him in a record store, except maybe at the Groove Merchant I would run into him there on occasion. But no, we never went out into the field together, as they say.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think I regret the most, other than just not staying in the Bay Area a little bit longer, and you know, especially when kind of got the bug to really DJ out a lot more.
Yeah.
Which seems like was really like the time after we'd already come down south.
Right.
But yeah, it was always kind of like mysterious. There was always like mystery to Matthew.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, and that was like one of the big mysteries to me, because I think there was only one time that I ran into him, like at a meet, like in the process of actually looking for records.
Yeah.
But he always had records. And so. Yeah.
I just think that his level of the record game was so many, you know, levels above what most of us were used to. So, you know, he was making moves, you know, bad boys move in silence, that sort of thing.
He would never, you know, there's like a little clip I'm going to throw in here somewhere. Like, he would never admit, like, how he got records. I remember him playing on Calyx, playing this song by this group, Grand Am, Get High, that Cut Chemist and Shadow use in product placement, mm-hmm. and I was tripping out. I was like, man, how did you get that? And he just had this like little smile on his face, and he's and kind of like shrugged his shoulder and said, you know, I have my ways.
You know, the thing is though, you know, one of the things that I spoke with him the last year or so was about how he was planning on gradually just selling off a lot of his record collection, and for someone who had amassed, again, one of the best collections out there, for him, it was really just about the music. The object itself didn't necessarily hold the same kind of fascination or obsession as it did when he was younger. And I think, unlike a lot of people, he was willing to let that go. And, you know, he sold off about a year ago. He sold off about 400 of his heaviest soul jazz pieces, probably stuff that, you know, we heard you play earlier today. And it didn't seem like a big deal to him. He didn't have the same sort of, again, obsessive attachment to the object. As long as he knew he had the music, that's what was important. And again, it's just sort of that openness and, you know, the lack of selfishness that really just kind of amazed me, because, you know, I haven't gotten to that point yet. I'm still gripping the records.
Yeah.
Speaking of the mystique, though, one of the things is, you know, he was an attorney for a while, mm-hmm. especially in the 90s. And then he left his firm. And for the longest time, no one I knew what he was doing. And we were like, did he just have like this massive nest egg? You know, where was he getting his money from? And it was just one of those things that people would talk about every like 6 months or so. Like, yeah, I ran to Matthew. Like, dude, what is that dude doing right now? And it was just, it was part of the mystique. Like, no one knew how he was getting by. And he was clearly, you know, doing pretty well for himself.
I think he must have just bought a lot of stock in Apple or something
like that. And, you know, he traveled a lot. I mean, he lived life really well. Yeah. You know, he really lived life well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's also one of the things that I always respected about Matthew, that, you know, he really, you know, he did what he loved. He loved the legal stuff too,
right,
and you know, like he kept at it, and especially stuff around intellectual property. Never got to talk to him really about that, but you know, I imagine his love of hip hop and of sampling kind of pushed him towards that. And so he did a lot of work for people who did record labels, and you know, getting licensing rights and all kinds of stuff like that.
Right, right.
But never let that kind of take over, you know, his passions. and music was definitely a really big passion of Matthew's. Yeah, thanks so much for coming in, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. Before I jet, I just want to say shout out to the Calyx crew, massive out there in LA and the internet, and of course the Bay Area. You know, it was an interesting station to be at in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But I would not have traded any of those experiences or the people that I met through, especially Matthew, but not limited to him. I mean, you and I met through Calyx.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, it's no disrespect to KPFK. It seems a little sacrilegious to be talking about a different station, but it's all part of the family of community and college radio exactly. here on the West Coast. But, I mean, what an amazing space and place to kind of come through and again, the community of people out there. So anyone out there who's connected with Calyx, you know, love for you. And again, my thoughts go out to Matt's widow and Matt's family and all the friends who knew him.
I'm going to be back with another hour of music in tribute to Matthew Africa here at KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot. Mm-hmm.